So can I start, Rona Topaz, by asking what brought you to Greenham? You said you were there in 1987.
Yeah, I was, yeah. Well, what brought me, as in how did I physically get there or why did I go there?
Why did you go there? But I suppose, yes, your physical journey as well would be great.
Well, I was living in Balham at the time, southwest London. Mm-hmm. And I can't quite remember, but it involved going to Paddington and then getting a train and then getting myself to Newbury and then getting myself to the camp. Mm-hmm. But I live much closer to it now.
Yeah.
In terms of why I went there, I had been waiting for a very long time for an opportunity to do something involving entertainment with the camp. And the reason I wasn't actually at the camp is because I was young, I was getting married soon, I had this kind of idea of a life mapped out for me that didn't involve going and camping with the other women, which I think that ideally if I'd been young, free and single and I had no responsibility to anyone else, I would have just thought about maybe just going to the camp and being there. And the reason for that is because I just feel really, really strongly about I think the human race is setting itself on a course to it's just the insanity of defense spending and the insanity of the idea of keeping Trident when there are other weapons that are 10 times more powerful than Trident. It's just the madness of it all. I just wanted to be part of the protest, be part of the whole people sort of saying, wake up, this is madness. Why are we doing this to ourselves? Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So did you go just just for a day or did you visit more than once?
Well, this is why I said that you probably wouldn't like what I had to say about it, because I went there for a specific project to entertain as part of a specific project. But I spent quite a few hours there. Mm-hmm. And my intention was to go back several times. And the more time I spent there, the less well I felt. Mm-hmm. Physically, I started to feel sicker and sicker and sicker and sicker. And I wasn't really sure whether it was because I had food poisoning from something I ate the day before, or whether it was the stress of performing, but it wasn't, because I was already by that time I was an experienced performer, so it wasn't stage fright, it wasn't nerves or anything like that. It seemed to start when I arrived. I was fine, and within an hour it seemed to start. It was like the worst migraine you've ever had, but it was a mixture of migraine and a stomach ache and just a feeling of just a feeling of very severe sickness. And it got worse and worse and worse and worse. And I was there for about 5-6 hours. And then by the time I performed, I wasn't at my best performance-wise, because I was just so unwell. Mm. And I just remember feeling I couldn't wait to leave. And I told my friends at the time, and they suggested that maybe there was something in the air that was making me feel sick. I don't know what it was. I can't pin it down to anything specific, but the whole feeling of the longer I was there, the sicker I got. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to take that risk of going back. And does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So do you think, because have you heard about zapping?
No.
Right, okay, because these are symptoms that a lot of Greenham women reported in their time there due to what they believe was zapping, so then the military using a weapon against them that made them feel like this.
Right.
So it's very interesting that you felt like that in your few hours that you were there.
Yeah, I mean, at least I know that there could have been an explanation for it. Because I've done a lot of singing engagements over the years, and even if they're a tough crowd or I get a little bit nervous, I've never felt like that.
No.
I've never I've never had a migraine like that. I've never had stomach pains like that. I've never felt that sick.
Mm.
And I'm glad to see that there might have been an explanation for it.
Yeah. So can you describe to us what you were performing? What was that experience like? Whereabouts at the camp you were, if you can remember?
It was a set of original songs.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about half an hour.
And do you know whereabouts at the camp you were, what gate you were at or anything? Do you remember any of that?
It was a long time ago. I know it was 1987. I know I was on a stage and I know I was at the camp. Other than that, I can't tell you anything else. It's so long ago. Sorry.
No, it's fine. Can you tell us a bit about the original songs then?
Yeah. I think... a lot of them were based on what I observed politically at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of them might have been just a little bit, I mean, you know, I was quite young. So some of the songs were just about, I think one of them was about Thatcher, and I think one of them was about how life could be better and we're making the wrong choices. There's a song that I actually, from then till now, there's a song that I still sing called Working Class Lament. And it's basically, it's a very generic song. And it's not just based on a particular politician, but it's based on the whole working class struggle throughout centuries. And it basically talks about how people have more power than they realise, and that they almost choose to accept the system that they're given, and that people don't, most people don't look outside of what they're given and what's on offer and ask for something more. It's about the fact that they just accept the way they're treated. And even if they're treated horrifically, they just accept it. And there are very, very few, particularly in this country, I'm not speaking internationally, but in this country, there's less of an inclination to say, well, no, this isn't good enough. Whereas in France or Brazil or places, you know, other countries, that even in Denmark, there was a huge protest in Denmark the other day. You know, they sort of say, well, yeah, we're not accepting this. This isn't good enough. But the song that I wrote then, that I still sing now, is about compliance and complicity from the working classes.
What do you think made you political and politicized in your life?
I think I can't pin it down to any one thing. I just, you know, I remember going to high school and hearing arguments in favour of, you know, horrific behaviour towards the Palestinians and the Israeli state, and saying, you know, thinking that they should have like a two-state solution or something. And you know, somebody kind of came up to me, you really think those Palestinians deserve their own state? And I remember sort of saying to them, but they're human beings, aren't they? And the kind of reaction I got. So, you know, that sort of made me think, well, wait a minute, why aren't more people feeling this way? You know, why are we like that? Why are we like that as a human race? And then, like, when I was older, reading books, just books that kind of opened my eyes, but reading Charles Dickens' books about the Victorian era, reading Thomas Burke. When I was about 19, I think that was the turning point, when I was about 19, and just coming across artists that I like Billy Bragg and Paul Weller, and just sort of seeing what their point of view was politically. And I got a lot of encouragement from a man called Mike Peters, who was the lead singer with a Welsh band called The Alarm, and he was very, you know, he was encouraging Weller, even Weller was encouraging in terms of my lyrics. He was saying, oh, so, you know, your lyrics like Blake's poetry, you should read more of Blake's poetry, and, you know, sort of read more about, you know, just being pointed towards the masters, you know. Reading about great political figures, reading about the whole what went wrong with the miners' strike, and Dennis Skinner and Tony Benn and everyone that was sort of around when I was young and impressionable in the 80s, and just being sort of drawn towards the left, I suppose, not, I don't want to call it the left wing, but being drawn towards what I would say is conscious democratic socialism, as opposed to the other. You know, to me, it's like democratic socialism represented me as a working class woman, and the government or the conservatives or, you know, whoever was in government at the time represented the people who had made it, and I hadn't made it. I was a working class student, and that was what was sort of, you know, it was just being just reading about things and just realizing things were not right, and that there were opportunities and things that could be done better, like spending, you know, why spend billions on Trident when we can be feeding our own people, that sort of thing.
Absolutely. Was your upbringing quite like, did you grow up in a political household, in a socialist household at all?
No, I did not. That's a short answer. No, I didn't.
And did you meet other people when you were there? What are your memories of people that you spoke to while you were there?
Again, I was getting sicker and sicker. So I did meet and chat to people, but then it was about 5 hours, 6 hours before I went on stage. And by that point, I'd started vomiting. So I was in no condition to meet anyone.
No.
In terms of like making long-term friendships or anything like that. I wasn't really, within an hour, I started getting very sick. So I couldn't really go out and socialize. I was just thinking to myself, when is this going to end? Because it was just, we might have to have some water, please, not being able to hold any food down. It wasn't the only thing that was pleasant about the experience of being a group was the fact that I was there and the fact that I, was making my own little contribution to the whole thing. I wish I'd been healthier. I just wish that the whole thing had gone better.
And have you been involved in other political movements since, the women's movement or anything? Could you tell us a bit about that and what else you've been involved in?
I'm at the moment I'm involved in quite a few things. I'm involved in a campaign for welfare reform, Centre for Welfare Reform. I'm involved with it's ROFA. I'm trying to remember what it stands for. They're campaigning for less discriminatory welfare system, particularly against disabled people. Also involved with disabled people against the cuts. I'm also involved with on the peace movement side, I'm actually involved with CND as part of the peace education program, and also involved with volunteering for a campaign for Zero Hours Justice. I've just written an article for their blog. I do a lot of telephone befriending, particularly since COVID. So I've been involved with sort of local mutual aid groups. I just have to sort of think about all the things I'm involved with. The London Renters Union, I've been involved with, helped making some calls on behalf of some of the people who have been affected by bad landlords. My landlord's terrible, so I wanted to see if I can help out other people who have got worse landlords than me, because at least my landlord is not kicking me out and allowing me to stay here. But there's other people who have just been treated appallingly by their landlords and just breaking every rule in sight, and they want to know what their rights are. So it's my responsibility and myself and the team to phone these people up and say, you do have rights as a renter. Come to one of our meetings, learn more about what you could do to stop your landlord from doing this, and learn what your legal position is. That's just a variety of things. Just wherever I feel I could do some good, really.
Absolutely. Why do you think, if this is your experience anyway, that people aren't that aware of Greenham?
Say again, why do I feel that people...
Aren't very aware of Greenham. So in history, a lot of people we found that we speak to of younger generations just don't know anything about the Greenham Common Women's Peace Camp. Why do you think that is?
Well, I find it strange that certain events just tend to be wiped out of history, whereas others stay.
Mm.
And Winston Churchill said that history is created by those, you know, something about that the most powerful people create their own, they create history or recreate history to shape their own political means. He said something along those lines anyway, and he's certainly living proof, well, not living proof, dead proof of it. but that's one of the reasons. I just think that possibly the powers that be have made sure that it's erased from the, you know, from recent, you know, from recent historical culture. Perhaps the idea of protesting against nuclear weapons has been somewhat ameliorated by the treaty that was signed by quite a few countries recently. Whilst we kind of carry on regardless, I also feel as if free speech is being shut down in this country. I also feel as if, you can't really sort of say that the left has been well archived and that the successful protest movements such as the Green and Common Women's Camp have been sort of memorialized in a way that has been particularly relevant in terms of, you know, I can't imagine it being taught in schools, for example. You know, I can't imagine it being, I mean, there's been people that have been very, very successful in their time. I mean, very, very successful in their time in changing a lot of government policy. I was in a play a couple of years ago. I was in a play about a woman called Kath Duncan, and her behavior and her actions and her movement had led to the formation of the NCLU, which became now known as Liberty. Mm-hmm. But I'd never heard of this woman until I was in the play. I played a few roles in the play, but I'd never heard of her. And the NCLU formed as a result of herself and a man called Fred something or other. You know, it was as a result of the fact that she was able to attract 100,000 people to Hyde Park or something. It was extraordinary at the time, 1930s, early 1930s. I'm not a historian, but still, I still should have heard of her.
Mm.
So I think that certain events stay in the historical framework and others just get wiped out for some reason.
Do you think that is to do with gender as well?
Oh yeah, yeah. We live in a misogynist world. So
Do you think that something like Greenham could happen again? Something on that scale?
I would hope that it would. Because human beings are still human beings, but I also feel as if we really are as malleable as Julian Assange thinks we are, it is a possibility that we will just become more kind of conditioned into accepting things that are not acceptable.
Mm.
And there is that possibility that it may not happen again, but I don't know. I'm not the right person to sort of say yes, it will, or no, it won't. I mean, I'd like to think that we're still human beings at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But I mean, I would also, just judging from the way, as a disabled person, just judging from the way people with learning disabilities, particularly people with learning disabilities, are being told, with the medical profession, being told not to resuscitate them if they have COVID. Just seeing that slippery slope they were going down, which kind of reminds me a little bit of Nazi Germany, where 380,000 people with learning difficulties were just out and out murdered by the Nazis.
Yeah.
It reminds me a little bit of that, and I just think that if we're going to go down that road without any protest, then, you know, next time it'll be older people, and then the next time it might be disabled people who aren't learning disabled people, like myself, for example, and then the next time it might be another group. And that's how the Nazis actually started. They started with, you know, people who weren't not worthy of life, quote unquote, and then they just moved on and escalated, and then, you know, 6 million Jews got murdered, and that's going on in our country now this week.
That's terrifying. Do you mind me asking you what your disability is?
I have several.
Okay.
I have a little bit of a mobility issue, which means that I can't stand for excessively long periods. Mm-hmm. And I have to sit down after 5-10 minutes, I suppose, and then I can get up again. And I mean, what I do is I either, when I perform, I can manage a half an hour actually on stage because of the adrenaline being on stage.
Yeah.
I'm usually quite sore when I come off, but usually I can stand for half an hour, up to half an hour on stage if need be.
Mm.
But I have a bit of a very bad back. I'm hard of hearing, so I have, wear hearing aids. And I've had 2 strokes.
Oh, wow.
So the second stroke has caused a bit of problems with my memory, my short-term memory.
Mm.
So you may have noticed that I was sort of struggling to remember things from 1987. And it probably would have been, it's probably maybe just even a global thing. It may just be memory full stop. But I particularly struggle with short-term memory.
Yeah. That's a lot to deal with. And yet you're still very active and doing lots of things. Could you tell us a bit about, you've said before in our emails about doing work in Forum Theatre. What yeah. drew you to that specific style of theatre?
Well, I was recruited to Forum Theatre Company many years ago and didn't know too much about it. And then I read Augusta Roel's Theatre of the Oppressed.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, this is for me. Political theatre, I love it. I love the idea of being able to solve political issues or social issues in a theatrical context. But to me, that's just the ultimate reward for me, being able to use the theatrical skills and performance skills and creative skills to be able to solve issues. I mean, we were basically, our company, I was with this company for 2 years, and we were doing domestic violence mainly and working in prisons. We did one political thing. We went to York Borough Council and did one sort of political conflict-related forum thing, but generally speaking, it's been with more social issues and interpersonal issues.
Mm. Yeah, really interesting, the idea of creating a piece of Greenham Theatre in Boal style, using Forum Theatre. Yeah, I really like that idea, definitely. Who, if you were going to do that, who would be your participants, do you think? Who would you like to create that with?
Good question. I think, with Forum Theatre, you don't necessarily have to be an actor. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I suppose like-minded people who would like to, who are interested in the issue and know a little bit about the context and would like to discuss the sort of interconnectivity because I don't think that nuclear weapons I think the whole thing it sounds simplistic, but I think the whole thing comes down to greed. I think a lot of what we don't particularly agree with in capitalism comes down to greed or excess greed. And I would like to unpick how we get to a point where we have food banks and people queuing in the snow, whereas we find the money for billions to spend on nuclear weapons. And I'd like to unpick how we allowed ourselves to get there.
Yeah, definitely. Have you done any work with young people as well?
Yeah, I have. I mean, the school's project, the CND, I've only just started with them, so I'm still sort of training. But that's for schools. I'm part of a charity called Nurture the Children. And it started originally in northern Nigeria, and it's now in this country as well. And the idea is it's a three-part school for education project, basically educating children about people who have sort of risen above the pack and done something to improve life. Including young people who have done that, and this is basically a project about emotional resilience and mental health and resilience. And there's like a pen pal scheme where they can write to children in Nigeria and exchange letters. And they do fundraising to support the food banks in Nigeria, but also they also do the fundraising to support food banks in the UK as well. So it's just a three-part school education project. And I'm one of the facilitators for that.
Oh, brilliant.
I don't want to think about them because we're all human beings at the end of the day, but I think also there is the elite and then there's us. And that may be very simplistic, but I do think that there is a very powerful system of establishments that controls the narrative. And they have created a sense of heroism around war and military and, you know, justification to justify the most horrific things, and don't get me started on colonialism. Do not get me started on colonialism. And I do think that it's an uphill battle to sort of represent the other side, which is, you know, peace and you know, living in fairly harmony with our fellow human beings. I think it's an uphill battle to represent that because it's seen as cowardice. And I don't think there's anything cowardly about being a kind of conscientious objector and being subjected to horrendous, you know, treatment in prison and you know, being ostracized by one's, you know, one's fellow human. Yeah. I don't think there's any cowardice in that at all. But it's something that I feel it's an uphill battle, but I also feel that We in the past, things that were illegal, we've been able to overturn a lot of things that were illegal in the past. And, yeah, you know, it's all come from the grassroots. It's all come from us. And I don't think there's any point in saying, oh, it's hopeless. We should just not bother. Yeah. I don't think that's going to get us anywhere. I think we can, you know, I think we have to continue. Yeah. I think the struggle is real. We have to continue it. So yeah, I'll just leave you with that, really. I mean, I as a performer, I've sent you the information that you need to know about me as a performer, but as a human being, it's something that I would just dearly love to be part of because it's close to my heart, really.
Yeah. Thank you so much for speaking to me today, Rona. It's lovely to meet you. Take good care of yourself.
Bye-bye. Thank you.